Lordship Prabhu and Srila Kirti could come and sit up here. Okay. Got a little assembly together. At this time, we're just going to hear something of Srila Prabhupada's pastimes, some remembrances from some of the senior devotees in the community. And we'll each talk for maybe 5 minutes or so. So I'd just like to begin by relating one of the many wonderful and infinite pastimes of Srila Prabhupada during his short sojourn on this planet. In 1968, six of us went to London with Prabhupada's blessings to open the center there. And after a year of very difficult times, we were able to procure one building in the center of London. And we knew that Prabhupada wanted this. So when he came, he was in a very happy mood. And at the time when he arrived, because we had just made a record of the Hare Krishna mantra with George Harrison and the Beatles label Apple, they were able to get a very large collection of press people to come and greet Prabhupada along with the devotees. So Prabhupada was very happy, and he was escorted from the plane into the VIP lounge. There was a big kirtan. Prabhupada led the kirtan. And he, after the kirtan, was immediately surrounded by newsmen. And they were, as usual, very aggressive. And the first question was, someone shoved a microphone towards him. "What have you come here to teach?" And Prabhupada said, "I have come here to teach you what you have all forgotten, God." So they were very stunned. They'd never heard anyone speak quite so strongly. And the devotees were also a little shocked. They were kind of stunned into silence. And then when Prabhupada went to his quarters, which were in John Lennon's estate, he began to speak about how England had fallen down so much from its former material glory of the emperors of the whole world. He said that formerly the sun never set on the British Empire, now it never rises on the British Empire. And he was making comments about this big estate, that how these young boys, musicians, could own such a big estate. This means nobody in this country has any money anymore when the rock and roll musician lives like a big millionaire. Then he talked a little about how Britain had fallen down, and he made some remark how he remembered a cartoon when he was in India, which was published in the newspapers after World War II. It showed the British lion, the emblem of Britain, lying curled up on the ground, all bandaged from head to toe. So he was in a very jovial mood, laughing about this British lion, which was injured and crippled and so on. He also told us that once his godbrothers told him, Prabhupada had said that he would go to, when he was in India, he told some of his godbrothers that he would go to the West one day. So one of his godbrothers said, "Yes, but when you go there, you'll have to learn how to eat with knife and fork and spoon." And Srila Prabhupada said, "When I go, I will teach them to eat with their hands." And once he sent me to make a bank deposit, he had an account at Lloyd's Bank. This is a great privilege to go and make a deposit in Prabhupada's account. I was feeling very excited about it. And when I got back, I brought him the passbook. It was a savings account. And he looked at it, and he kind of nodded. And he said, the receipt. So I said, well, Prabhupada, they just stamped the passbook. They didn't give me a receipt. And then he just looked at me kind of incredulously, like, how could they have not given you a receipt? So then he asked again, why did they not give a receipt? So I said, well, Prabhupada, I just thought that if they stamped the passbook with the amount, that that was the same thing. He goes, no, not at all the same thing. You know what this means? So then I made some offerings what this meant, that I was very forgetful. I should have asked to receive. No. So then I offered that the teller had made a mistake. He wasn't doing his job very well. No. Then something about the bank, that their system wasn't correct. Maybe they didn't offer receipts. No, that is not correct. So then he just looked off for about 2 or 3 minutes out in the distance. And then finally he began to relate a very long story. The whole story of how Britain had fallen down from her former greatness. And the conclusion of this story, which went on for quite some time, was that this fact that they couldn't give a simple receipt for making a bank deposit was the proof that Britain had now fallen to the lowest status of any country in the world. And then he said, your country is the best country for spreading Krishna consciousness, meaning America. Then, about 3 years later, during the Rath Yatra at Trafalgar Square, one of the candidates for initiation came forward. He was about 55 years old, a chief security man in the Midlands Bank, one of the biggest banking systems, to become initiated. So this was a very significant event because the initiation, which included a big blazing fire sacrifice, big fire, done out of doors in Trafalgar Square, which is probably Britain's most famous monument. It's right at the base of Lord Nelson's column. And of course, Lord Nelson is one of the great symbols of British imperialism and the great dynasty of Britain. So here was Srila Prabhupada, who had come from India, a former colony of Britain, under this 100-foot column, or maybe 50-foot column, of Lord Nelson, stands on the top of this column, who is the great symbol of colonizing the world. Srila Prabhupada was initiating a middle-aged English banker before a great blazing fire in Trafalgar Square. And it was a very significant event. There's a very wonderful picture of this taking place. You can see one church in the background. And the British authorities tried to stop the Rath Yatra after that. They actually gave us a written statement that it would no longer be able to have this in Trafalgar Square. Of course, by Krishna's grace, we were able to reverse their judgment. But this is was a wonderful victory for Srila Prabhupada, that he had come to re-implement Britain's greatness in this way. So, Shruti Kirti, you want to speak for me?
I wanted to try something this morning. If it doesn't work, I can try to remember something. But I wanted to see if there were any questions that anyone might have about my service with Prabhupada, being with him for some time, some things that maybe you would want to know about Prabhupada's daily life, his activities, and I would try to answer them. So, Lochan? His question was, what sort of prasadam did Prabhupada like the most? We can start by saying the prasadam that he took was usually very simple for breakfast. for breakfast prasadam, Prabhupada usually would take what was ever locally available and fresh in, as far as fruit was. One time, like in Switzerland, of course, we were in Switzerland once, happened to be there in springtime. And also this happened in England, in London very often, where Prabhupada would be given these fruits from other places, like avocados. Like in, you know, London you can't get avocados, but of course in the market you could buy avocados or mangoes. But Prabhupada wasn't very fond of imported fruits. They had a tendency to be not very sweet, kind of bland. And so he liked whatever was available and fresh. He would take some fruits, and then he liked his milk sweets. Sandesh Rasgulla were some favorite milk sweets. And usually chickpeas and ginger. He would never start his breakfast without ginger. There were some exceptions, but for the most part he had to have ginger to start. And over the course of time that I was with him, sometimes I would forget the ginger. And it was usually very upsetting for Prabhupada, and pretty upsetting for myself, because he would yell and say, how can I eat? There's no ginger. Then I have to run downstairs. And he would actually wait. He wouldn't start eating until the ginger was there, which sometimes he would mix it with lemon and a little salt, and that took away the sting of the ginger, kind of mellowed it out. But he said that started the fire within his stomach, fire of digestion. So he liked to start with some ginger, and then chickpeas, or if chickpeas weren't around, fried cashews. He liked fried cashews very much. And then just fruit. He didn't eat anything very heavy usually for breakfast. Although sometimes traveling to colder places, like if he happened to be in London or somewhere where the winter was very cold, then he would like a little halava. He said, because when it was colder out, he said he could eat more. It wasn't that he wanted everyone to eat like that, but he said for him it was difficult to digest grains in the morning. And lunchtime was very simple. He didn't eat very many fried things. Like he wasn't eating pakoras and samosas every day for lunch. He ate a very simple lunch, which was always chapatis. It was chapatis, rice, dal. And he would try to start with a bitter vegetable, which was usually bitter melon, just with a little salt and turmeric that was fried. And again, that created appetite and helped to digest the food. So he liked to start his meal with a little bitter melon. And chapatis, it was usually, he would take three or four chapatis, of which they were always cooked one at a time. So when I would bring Prabhupada his lunch, he would come, he would sit down on the floor just on one little, not even a pad, but just a cloth on the floor with a little table, which was called a chokhi. And I would bring just one chapati, and then as soon as he started eating, I would have to run back down, go into the kitchen or wherever I was doing the cooking, and then make the next chapati, and then bring that back up. So it was, constant back and forth, bringing him fresh chapatis. And if you could bring them to him while they were still inflated, then, he liked that, because then he would poke it down and the hot air would come out of the chapati. But sometimes he would actually eat, he would eat according with, whatever he was able to take. Sometimes he would eat as many as six or eight chapatis with a meal, and then, you would be like in ecstasy that Prabhupada had eaten so much prasadam. But there were times over the course of time I was with him, sometimes his health was feeling very good, and he would eat, he would actually like clear out all the bowls of vegetable on the plate. He would eat all his rice, and it was like really a wonderful experience. There was once, this was back in 1974, that Prabhupada was very ill in Vrindavan this time, and it was questionable if he would recover. He was practically didn't eat anything for 2 weeks. He was eating just a little orange and, every day. Sometimes he would eat some grapes, and he was drinking his milk with Horlicks. I think it's called Horlicks in it. He was for energy. But after a few weeks of that, he was trying to recover. And he was asking people to cook him so many different things, you know. He would tell one Indian woman, I forget what her name was, but he was asking, you know, you cook this. And he was like trying all kinds of ways that he would start eating by having preparations that he liked. And one morning he asked me to cook him upma. And in Vrindavan there wasn't so much availability of vegetables, so I didn't know what I was going to do. And I remember Jamuna was there and different devotees, but she was the one that assisted the most. So I said, you know, what am I going to use for making upma? Anyway, she had some dehydrated peas. So we got some water in them, and we made upma. It was just with, you know, the grain and these dehydrated peas. And I took it to Srila Prabhupada for his breakfast. And he ate a little bit. And I came back in 5 minutes, and I was just sitting there watching. And he said, I wanted you to know that this upma was very good. He said, this was really very good upma. He said, I haven't eaten very much because my health is not so good. He said, but I wanted you to know that it was very good upma. So, that was very nice. And of course, some of his favorites, we've heard of his favorites. He liked kachori very much. But these were things, and he wouldn't take very often because it usually wasn't very good for him. It was difficult to digest. In the evenings, sometimes he had a favorite preparation in the evenings. He had several favorites, but one of them was puffed rice. Puffed rice with peanuts and some sliced cucumber on the side. That was something, you know, that Prabhupada ate all the way back from his very childhood. He was very fond of puffed rice. So if he was feeling some hunger in the evening, puffed rice was one of his favorites, because then he could still eat and fill himself up, he said. And a few hours later, after he took rest, he could get up and translate, and he wouldn't feel very heavy from, you know, having to digest so much food, because it was very easy to digest. But sometimes he didn't follow that either, and he would have, like, you know, three or four parathas with an eggplant and potato vegetable and always a glass of hot milk at night. And he taught me to make over the years a few different preparations that he was very fond of. Vegetables. More than anything, he really liked vegetable preparations. And he taught me to make a few of them. One was of course, another well-known vegetable. This is wet cauliflower and potatoes and fried curd. And he showed me how to make that once. And a few of them, when he would show me how to make them, after I had perfected it, which hopefully was after one showing, he would eat it for like 6 or 7 days in a row. He would just say, make this vegetable, you know, for lunch. Whatever else there was, there had to be that vegetable, and he would, like, you know, eat it every day. It was like something special, a little treat. And one was cabbage. It was a very simple cabbage preparation, but in the way it was cut up very finely with some small cubes of potatoes that were fried in the chance. In the beginning, it was like a real, you know, very tasty preparation, although it was cabbage and potatoes. So Prabhupada was like very expert at cooking, and he knew how to show one to cook, and then he would eat these preparations. Parathas was another one he liked. After he showed me how to eat parathas, it's like every night for a week, you know, there would be parathas, and I would always make a large dough. Because after Prabhupada was finishing parathas, there were a few others, like Prajumna at the time, who was around, and myself, and Shyama Sundar. We would all be, you know, 9, 9:30 at night, eating 3, 4 parathas and a bunch of vegetables. It was nice. Is there anything? The question was that Prabhupada didn't like... Oh. He wasn't very much in favor of fasting or big austerities for the devotees. Yes, that's true. There were several times. Once was with Jadarani some years back when all of Los Angeles practically was fasting for one thing or another. You know, if there'd be the slightest little disease, the idea was to fast for a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks. And one of them was Jadarani, and when Prabhupada heard about it, he would always get very upset and say, you know, this is, you know, it's not good to fast like this. Something must be taken, he would say, even if it's a little fruit. Now, Prabhupada many times would say that eating fruit is fasting. But you have to take some fruit, he would say, because the super soul is also there. He said the spirit soul and the super soul is within the body, and you have to feed. You know, you have to feed the. So he didn't think it was a good process of getting well was to not eat, but eating proper things. You know, so many times people would come up to me and say, you know, how much are you supposed, what does Prabhupada say are you supposed to eat? I mean, back in the early 70s, it was, you know, there were all kinds of rumors that you're only allowed 8 chickpeas for breakfast, or, you know, 2 chapatis at lunch, and if you ate more than 2 chapatis, you were just in Maya. And, you know, these things would even be brought to Prabhupada's attention. And the one time he said, it's common sense. Of course, everything Prabhupada would always say, it was just common sense. He said, for one person eating 1 chapati, he said, is too much. And for another person, eating 10 is not enough. He said, there's a question of your constitution, your bodily constitution. So, you know, one has to exercise some intelligence. Yeah. Myself, I also went through some of these things when I was with Prabhupada, and it always resulted in the same for me, and Prabhupada always told me to eat more, that I wasn't eating enough. On one occasion, I had, this was also in Bhaktivedanta Manor, and I decided that I should start eating less, that I was eating too much, and I should eat less and help control my senses. So I did it at a very good opportunity. It was Janmashtami, which we fasted the whole day. So then that night, all I had was a little fruit salad at midnight. And then the next day, of course, was Prabhupada's appearance day. And again, when we broke fast at noontime, I ate practically nothing. And because I was not eating very much, it was very easy. You ate a little bit and I would become very full. And then the next day, again, I was just continuing to not eat so much. And I went into Prabhupada's room, and I paid my obeisances and got up, and Prabhupada looked at me and he said, are you feeling all right? I said, yes, Prabhupada. I said, I feel fine. He said, you don't look very good. He said, you look a little drawn. I said, well, I've been trying not to eat very much. And he said, this is not good. He said, you have your service to do. He said, you should eat as much as you can. He said, how are you going to do your service? He said, you have to give massage. He said, you have so many things. He said, you have to eat. I said, yes, Prabhupada. And almost the identical thing happened to me another time. Of course, I had, you know, tendency to forget. So a year later, I did the same thing. And again, he said the same thing. He said, you can't. He said, you should eat more. So since that time, I've always I've always eaten whenever and whatever I want, by Prabhupada's mercy. But, you know, there are actually so many, like, wonderful pastimes in relationship with prasadam and Prabhupada. It's like, you know, very numerous. He would always want to see all his disciples just, you know, eating very nicely. There was no question that they should be, you know, hungry or trying to sustain on a little prasadam. He wanted everyone with, you know, had plenty of prasadam. But he also insisted that, you know, whatever you take, you finish. You know, you say, at one time it was at a big life member's house. There was the whole temple was there, about 30 devotees, and devotees were starting to finish and get up, and Prabhupada looked, and he would look to see if anyone was leaving prasadam, and he would say, you know, waste not, want not. So everyone, you know, was very conscious that whatever you ask for, you finish. Sometimes he would walk in, and there was once when, in India, of course, everyone was always getting sick, and, you know, you're trying all kinds of diets to stay healthy, you know, eating just rice and bananas, or eating just vegetables with no spices, And whenever you did something like that, the tendency was, because you aren't satisfying your senses very much, you would have to eat three times as much as if you were eating just regular, you know, spiced foodstuffs. Nitai had this big mound of prasadam. And Prabhupada was, he would walk through the servants' quarters. This was in Vrindavan. He would walk through the servants' quarters then to go to the bathroom. And we were all sitting there and eating, and Nitai had this huge plate of prasadam, and Prabhupada looked at him. He said, "Are you going to finish all of that?" Nitai said, "Yes, Prabhupada." He said, "All right then." He said, "As long as you finish it." He didn't chastise him for having so much prasadam. He said, "But are you going to finish all of that?" He said, "Yes, I'll finish it." He said, "All right then, that's all right." So that was the tendency. Fasting, Prabhupada himself, he would, you know, his thing was that he couldn't eat. Sometimes he was in such a situation, he had no appetite, but he would always try to put something in, you know, drink a little milk or drink a little orange juice, or eat some grapes. His tendency was to try to avoid not eating. Is that right? Because Prabhupada was compassionate upon all living entities, but I, you know, when I was with him, I had many experiences with mosquitoes, having to assist Prabhupada in not being bothered by mosquitoes. Usually he would take all precautions, like in a place like Bombay, mostly in India. In other countries there wasn't so much trouble, but in a place like India, mosquitoes were, they were everywhere. And he would sometimes, we went to different temples, they would have the mosquito nets, like double bed size, and they would just drop it over his whole desk, you know, his sitting place where he did all his work. And, you know, sometimes they created so much trouble that, you know, he would just spend his night, he wouldn't even go to bed, you know, he would stay there because of the mosquito net was there, and that way he didn't have to be disturbed by the mosquitoes. But usually in the process of putting up those nets, you know, at least a half a dozen mosquitoes would be in the net also when you put the net up, because there were just so many of them around. And the usual course was, in the evening I would give Prabhupada a light massage without any oil, just a kind of a rub down. And sometimes during the massage I would have to stop a few mosquitoes. And I would be massaging, and there were times when they were so bad, as I was massaging him, I would be, you know, hitting his body in different spots, killing the mosquitoes. But he would say that if a mosquito was attacking, then it was all right to kill. Because it was, you know, these are one of the aggressors. When someone is attacking, then he can be. So in that way, we would eliminate some mosquitoes. But he was very, Prabhupada was very funny. He would say things like, you know, the mosquito, he is giving warning. You know, first thing he'll do before he bites, he'll always fly by your ear and say, "Here I am, I'm coming." "I'm coming to, you know, cut you," Prabhupada would always say, "I'm coming to cut you." And sometimes, like, in the morning he would get up and he said, "Some mosquito has cut my forehead, you know, over the night." And he'd say, "Mosquito always gives his warning, so if you take heed of the warning, then you can, you know, avoid." But sometimes it just wasn't possible. Then there were, you know, I mean, there were other instances. Once also, this was in Bhaktivedanta Manor, it was a very incredible for me. One morning, it was about 5 a.m. At that time in the morning, I would usually go in and get things ready for Prabhupada's morning walk and get his twig, his datung, for brushing his teeth, and like get all that ready. And I came in this morning and Prabhupada was sitting there and he was just looking. And he says, "Do you see that bug?" And I was, you know, right. I said, "Yes, Prabhupada, I'll do that." But he was like, so, you know, he said, all night I've been watching this bug, and I was thinking, you know, I mean, probably he was so concerned about this little bug that it would find a flower petal or something. And I mean, I was just, you know, envisioning, he's doing his translation work of the Bhagavatam, you know, and he would stop every now and then and he'd look at the bug. I mean, it was just inconceivable. So, I mean, he had that concern, you could see. Other living entities in the smallest body, the spirit soul is there.
Go back to the side. What was the Srila Prabhupada's reaction to the side? Very nice.
He could be very critical about Prashadam. I myself was criticized on quite a few occasions, I think. Once in Calcutta. India was usually the only place I didn't cook for Prabhupada, because in India there were usually people that knew how to cook decently. After being there for so many months, there was always someone that could cook. But sometimes I would have to, which I never liked, because it was always so difficult to cook in India. Just getting, just lighting a fire there took an hour. It was a major operation. But during this time in Calcutta, it was very convenient. They had a little propane tank and a two-burner stove that was just for Srila Prabhupada, nobody else. So I was cooking for him day after day, and I was very proud. I was thinking that, Prabhupada's eating every day, and he hasn't said anything about the prasadam. He's just been eating it. He hasn't criticized it or anything. And it was just that very day. I was walking in with his lunch, feeling very nice, that everything was going on so well and Prabhupada was enjoying. And I put the prasadam down and then I left to get another chapati. And when I came back, Prabhupada said, "What is this?" He said, "This dal," he said, "it's just like mud." He said, "Every day," he said, "you bring me this dal." "And it's just like mud." And I thought, well, there goes that. So I was always very quiet when Prabhupada chastised. I usually didn't have much to say. "Yes, Prabhupada, you're right." And he would say, "Don't you know how to cook dal?" He said, "You've been cooking for so many years." He said, "And you still don't know how to make dal?" He said, "You just make it like mud." And so I learned my lesson in regards to how well I was cooking for him that time. There were sometimes in temples he would be brought deity prasadam. If he stayed in a temple usually for a week or so, he would always get around to sampling deity prasadam. He would like to see how the deities were eating. And there were some times when he didn't think that the deities were eating very nice. He would use, expressions like, "This food is garbage. They're feeding the deities this garbage." He would call in the necessary people and chastise them. Or sometimes I would transfer the message and give it to them myself. But this was, of course, back, I don't know what it's like now, but when Prabhupada used to go to Australia, it was one of the places that he always relished the prasadam there. He liked the way they were preparing prasadam in Australia at that time very much. And usually they were using a lot of curd. The vegetables practically daily would have this fried curd in it. In fact, Prabhupada, instructed them in that way to feed the karmis, these vegetables, which Prabhupada named it the meat eater's delight. And it was kind of a combination of fried curd and eggplant and tomato, but it was, very tasty. And Prabhupada would practically always eat the temple prasadam. I can, remember not even cooking for him in Australia for days at a time, which was very unusual. Because in most places, he couldn't eat temple prasadam. I'm trying to think of other instances about the foodstuffs I prepared, but I can't think of anything offhand. It was usually all right. And on many occasions, actually, Prabhupada complimented the sandesh. He said that I was a very expert sandesh maker, and I used to make him sandesh almost every day. Of course, he taught me how to make it. Maybe that's why. But he said it was very first class. It was one of his favorite things. I got probably the most chastised once here in Los Angeles, and it was in relationship to prasadam, although it wasn't the taste of it. It was the way I was doing it. It was upstairs in the servants' quarters areas, where also there was a small two-burner stove, and it's also where I slept and where I cooked and where, you know, I sat through the day. And I had a little table. It was just a board, like, you know, a 1-inch board by 12 inches wide and 6 foot long, and it was on a couple milk crates. And in the milk crates were the supplies that I used. The spoons, knives, walks, everything like that. And it was after breakfast. After breakfast sometime, you know, maybe 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, I would start to prepare his lunch, start to cut up vegetables and make the chapati dough, because during the lunch is when everything would cook. I mean, during the massage, while I was massaging him, everything was cooking in the cooker. So it was like simultaneous. The services were going on. So before the massage, I would have to prepare everything. So on this day, I had taken Prabhupada's breakfast plates. And for breakfast, he always had orange. Orange was like, you know, every day of the year, practically, Prabhupada would have orange for breakfast. And I distributed the prasadam, and the orange peels I threw in the trash can that I had. It was right under the table that I prepared on. And Prabhupada was walking in the hallway, used the bathroom, and he was just kind of walking back and forth in the hallway chanting. And he walked into the room, and everything in the room looked very nice. It was clean. And I was cutting up the vegetables above the little board on the board there, and the trash can was underneath. And he just came in and he looked, and he, you know, he started screaming. And he said, "You fool." He said, "You malecha. you yavana," he said, "look what you're doing." And I didn't even know what it was I was doing. I was just cutting up his vegetables. He said, "You're such a fool." He said, "You know, you're such a malecha." He said, "You know," he said, "you Westerners are such malechas." I said, and I just looked, and he said, "How can you do that?" He said, "There you are." He said, "Preparing." He said, "You're preparing lunch." He said, for the deities." And, of course, he was a deity that I was preparing lunch for. So, see, this was my consciousness. I was just preparing his meal. He said, "You're preparing lunch for the deities." And he said, "But you have the garbage," he said, "sitting there from these orange peels." He said, "They're sitting there. It's garbage." He said, "And you're cooking right there at the same place." And, you know, so I was just sitting and shaking my head, yes. And he said, "You know, why are you such a fool?" He said, "Do they do that in the temple?" He said, "Do they do that in the temple kitchen?" And I said, "No, Prabhupada." He said, "Do they have garbage like that in the temple kitchen?" I said, "Well, you know, they have trash cans, but," I said, "they don't put, you know, the garbage, the eaten food in it." He said, "So then why are you doing it?" And of course I was thinking, well, this is Prabhupada's remnant. But I didn't say that. I just kind of whispered, "I'm just a fool, you know." And he said, "Everything in here is so nice." He said, "I've noticed you keep everything very nice. The room is always very clean." He said, "But then you go do something like this." He said, "You're such a fool. You're such a malecha." And this went on for like 15 minutes. This was not, and this wasn't just, you know, 2 or 3 minutes. When Prabhupada wanted to, you know, do something like that, and he, you know, whatever his reasons may be, he could do it for very extended periods. He was very expert, you know, in chastising like that. But that was one of the, there were many others. That was one of them. Lentils, he said, weren't considered vegetarian, I think, because they were so high in protein. There are other times, items like that, he would say, you know, they're not offerable to the deities. He said, but if you want to eat them, you know, and offer them or something separately, you could, like brown rice. You know, so many controversies about white rice and brown rice. And he said, if somebody wants to eat brown rice, he said, they can eat it. He said, but it shouldn't be offered to the deities. But lentils, and he would say, weren't offerable. No, ever since back in the late 60s, I guess, when Prabhupada had his heart attack, or one of his heart attacks, he was advised by a doctor, you know, not to bathe so early in the morning because it was very difficult on the body. So all through the years, he would always take his bath right around noontime, right before lunch. And it was a warm bath. In the morning, he would, before going on the morning walk, he would always wash himself thoroughly and brush his teeth, which also, you know, that was like a 10 or 15 minute brushing. It wasn't, you know, quick brush with a toothbrush in there. Except for the last few years, he always used a twig, which was either, in India it was always neem, and in the United States or places like Europe, it was, you know, whatever you could get that was, had a bristly effect. Eucalyptus was one of his favorites. That was also, there are also many interesting things that happened, you know, trying to find Prabhupada a toothbrush in the morning. It was one of my more anxiety-filled moments, you know, when you'd come to the Western countries and try to find a twig. I mean, I can, you know, remember, like, all of a sudden it's like 5 o'clock and you remember that Prabhupada doesn't have his twig, you know, and you'd be running around looking for a tree, some tree that, you know, had a nice bristly effect, you know, and wasn't very brittle, to have to, you know, put his twig in the bathroom. So in the morning he would brush his teeth, and before going out, Prabhupada would always, you know, he would always make sure of a few things. One is that he had his tilak on, and the other, he had his bead bag. He would say this was, you know, the mark of a Vaishnava, to go out with tilak and bead bag, and it was just, you know, presenting a Vaishnava to the outside world. Like in the airplanes, the very last thing he would do, usually after the seatbelt sign went on, he would get up and go to the bathroom, and then he would come back and he would put tilak on. If you notice, whenever Prabhupada arrived at the airport, he always had tilak on. It wasn't that he came in and there was no tilak, you know, but he would always put his tilak on. Sometimes it was, we got a lot of special mercy being with Prabhupada, of course. Like I can remember on occasion where Prabhupada would put his tilak and he would have some left, and he would hold out his hand to me to take, you know, the remainder of the tilak so I could put tilak on. That was, you know, a little interesting. Nectar came like that. And so he would take the one bath, which was right before lunch. That was also, being with Prabhupada, things were, for Prabhupada, everything, you know, we tried to make go as smoothly as possible, like the times, his bath, and the availability of water. But for the people that were with him, like, you know, his servants and secretary, in order to do that was sometimes, like, really amazing. Like in a place like India, where all of a sudden there was no electricity, there's no hot water, and, you know, Prabhupada's massage would be done, and then it would be, all right, you know, where's the hot water? And if there wasn't hot water, you may as well be in another country, you know, because, you know, Prabhupada just, you know, couldn't tolerate it. I mean, he'd be there standing filled with his body covered with oil. And sometimes, like in India, I would use an immersion heater, because things you just stick in the bucket of water. Usually you get shocked when you do it. You would stick it in the bucket and you would come back an hour later and there would be a bucket of hot water. Then you would mix the bucket of hot water with a bucket of cold water, and you'd have two buckets of warm water. Then there would have to be a third bucket for him to, you know, mix. And but sometimes you would get back from the massage and the heater wasn't on, you know, it blew out or the electricity went out, and there would be a bucket of cold water there. And it was just like, you know, you didn't even want to go into his room until you first had the bucket of hot water. I mean, there were actually times where, you know, I automatically knew I would go and there'd be no water, and then I would hear the buzz, you know, or the bell, and it would just be ringing, and, you know, like somebody would say, you know, Shutakirti is ringing. I'd say, yes, I know he's ringing for you. And I'd be trying to, you know, heat up some water very quickly. You know, well, you better go up there. I said, but I don't have any water. If I go up, he's just going to yell at me and tell me to get the water. So, you know, you had to figure out what to do. But, you could always get it within a few minutes, even if you had to rub two sticks together to do it. You would think of something, you know, to get him hot water. Mukunma? Traveling? Yes. Let's see. Anything in particular? There was one of the more remarkable things that happened. I told this to some devotees a few weeks ago. Was in South America, and it was aboard some South American airlines. Which I don't know what the name of it was, but all the stewardesses and stewards, they were all Spanish, South American descent of some sort. And it was a very nice airline, and we had just left. I think it was, I don't know whether it was Jakarta or India, but some Indian person had made Prabhupada some puffed rice. Like it was homemade puffed rice. And that's all we had on the plane was this package. It was just an aluminum foil. And after takeoff and everything, Prabhupada, wanted some prasadam. And that was the prasadam, was this puffed rice. So it was, Prabhupada was by the window. He always sat at the window, Prabhupada, when we took a flight, always sat at the window. And then I was next to him, and next to myself was a Paramahamsa. And I took out the puffed rice, like I say, it was all we had. And then the airplane, of course, we didn't have any arrangement. And I gave the other half to Paramahamsa Swami, who was sitting on the aisle. So we were both there munching on our puffed rice, and Prabhupada was just sitting. And this stewardess came by, and she just kind of, she was walking by, and she just looked, she just looked at the puffed rice, and she stuck her hand in and grabbed some right out of my plate. It wasn't even out of Paramahamsa's plate, it was out of mine, who was sitting in the middle. And she just grabbed it, and she popped it in her mouth. And she said, this is very good, Of course, we were like, everyone was awestruck. And, immediately I thought, this woman's really gotten some special benediction. I mean, she's been, just directed by Super Soul to take this Maha Prasadam. So then she's, said, what is it? And Prabhupada just kind of, ignored the whole situation. He was just sitting there, and I was doing the talking, and I explained it was puffed rice and how it was made. And she was like really, she was really into it. And she said, well, would you like something? She said, I can get you some fruits from the first class section. I'll bring you back some fruits. And I said, yes, that'd be very nice. And I said, Prabhupada, do you want anything? And he would say, hot milk. On a plane, Prabhupada would always like to get hot milk, which sometimes also is very difficult to ask a stewardess for hot milk. It was, asking him for the world, to plug in their little heater and make you some hot milk. But she said, oh, all right, I'll get it right away. So, in the next 20 minutes, she brought us a bunch of fruit and some hot milk and anything else she could, thought that we might eat. And so I tried this. I said to Prabhupada, this is really something. And Prabhupada said, said it's natural. Women, they have this motherly tendency to be like this. But, in the course of like 30 flights that I was with him, I never saw it very often. Because I was usually the one who had to try to get these things. And, for the most part, especially in America, people were all very rude and hard to deal with. But, this was a very unique situation. Another time, it was also Prabhupada did a lot of benedicting, was on an airplane, was same three seats. And it was a long flight, so we would always get the three seats together. So then later on in the flight, the servant and secretary, we could go find somewhere else to sit, and Prabhupada would lie down. And in this particular flight, he was lying down in such a way that his head was against the window, but his feet were sticking out in the aisle. So, over the course of hours, these people were constantly, we would watch them and kind of, laugh and just be amazed that people were walking back and forth, and they'd be brushing against Prabhupada's lotus feet, and they'd go this way and that way. So it was, Prabhupada, no matter what he was doing, he was always, just benedicting all the living entities in various ways. And in this one was especially nice. I mean, it was even difficult for his disciples. After like 73, you were told by your temple authority that if you tried to touch Prabhupada's feet when he came into the temple or something, that, you would be arrested, no one was allowed to touch, you know, Srila Prabhupada's feet because he was, you know, suffering reactions, he was getting ill from it, but he was sometimes very merciful. How much time do we have, Vasal? Okay. There's one in particular I'll try to remember. It was in Kurukshetra in India, which is about 1 hour outside of Delhi, I think. And Prabhupada had been very ill. This was when he was just leaving. He was just leaving Vrindavan, and he was going, I believe it was to Australia, to supposedly he was going to go there, and he was just going to rest. He wasn't going to do any management, any preaching. He was just going to rest. So we were in Delhi, and someone who had been a temporary prime minister or something after Gandhi, her last time out, I forget what his name was, some Indian man, but he had organized this Bhagavat Dharma discourse, and it invited all these different bogus yogis and gurus from all over India. And his goal was, as he was telling Prabhupada these things, his goal was to try to, you know, bring unity with all the religions in India. This is, of course, like an everyday event in India. There's someone that's trying to unify all India's religions, you know, all the different groups. And so this was what he was doing, and he was having it in Kurukshetra, which was, of course, where, you know, Bhagavad Gita was spoken. And, you know, his idea was that somehow we would all, everybody would join. So he was asking all the different religious leaders, and he invited Srila Prabhupada. And for the next day, it was going back and forth, you know, Prabhupada said, should I go? And we would all say, no, you shouldn't go, Prabhupada, you know, just going to waste your time, and, you know, no one's going to listen there, and, you know, you're trying to recuperate now, and you're still very weak, and it's such a long distance in a car, we have so many reasons. And went back and forth, and Prabhupada would say yes, and then he would call in Brahmananda later on and say, but I shouldn't, you know, miss this opportunity to preach. You know, that's my mission. I'm a sannyasi, I must preach. And so finally he decided to go. And it was arranged, a nice vehicle was arranged for Prabhupada to go, some Indian man's big Mercedes or something. And it was only something like, it would have been like a half hour ride if it was America, but it was like a 2.5 hour ride on these Indian roads. It was this, you know, very treacherous, small little road going off to Kurukshetra. And when Prabhupada arrived there, it was the first day of a 3-day meeting. They were going to meet for 3 days and discuss. And there were about a half a dozen of Prabhupada's disciples with him. Now, their idea when they got Srila Prabhupada there was they wanted to make him like the MC. They actually didn't want him to speak anything, because they knew that if he started speaking, it wasn't going to be very nice in their estimation. It wasn't going to be very flowery and say, oh yes, you know, we're doing so many things. They actually knew that he was dangerous to them. So they just wanted him to be like the master of ceremonies and introduce all these bogus gurus. So anyway, we were all sitting there for about an hour listening. Of course, most of us didn't have to listen because they all spoke in Hindi or Bengali or something, and you couldn't understand them. In fact, at one point, I took off for a half hour and took a dip in the lake there. And it was, the lake was the Battle of Kurukshetra. There's a famous lake. Yeah, right. Of course, it wasn't red. It yeah, it settled to the bottom. So, and then I came back, and they were still all speaking. And so finally, it just got to a point where Prabhupada stood up, and he started speaking. And he went on for about 20 minutes. It wasn't very long. It was just about 20 minutes, and it was in Hindi. But we could understand a bit of what he was saying, because he was quoting a lot of Bhagavad Gita. And he was, you know, speaking very... harshly to them. And after he finished, you know, everyone just got up and left. It was like it was the end, you know, that was it, you know. He just ended it. And so we all got back in the car, and Prabhupada was like very proud, and he was kind of laughing. And he said, do you know what I was telling them? And he said, I guess you don't. He said, you don't understand Hindi. And we said, well, yeah, we could understand some of it. He said, yes. He said, I was telling him, you are all such fools. He said, you think you're going to unify. He said, you're never going to unify, he said, until you accept Krishna's instructions. He said, you're all a bunch of fools and rascals. He said, you're coming here to Kurukshetra and you're talking about unifying. He said, but no one here has even mentioned Krishna. He said, you're speaking in Kurukshetra, the place where he spoke Bhagavad Gita, and he said, yet no one is saying anything about Krishna. He said, no one even accepts Krishna. He says, until you accept Krishna, he said, all your work will be useless. And that was the basic lecture that he gave. And we were all in the car going, Jai. And he was very proud of himself. And we just left. That was it. You know, we went back to Delhi. And as far as the rest of the ceremonies, I think it was more or less finished. You know, that Prabhupada devastated the whole place. And then, he was especially in India. You know, Prabhupada, when he spoke in India, he was very heavy. You know, with the Indian people. If you can listen to his lecture tapes, you'll see he would always be reminding them that it was their duty to be spreading Krishna consciousness. That's I'll have to think. Is there anything else? Japa. Prabhupada, of course, when he got up in the morning, which could vary from anywhere from midnight to 3 o'clock in the morning to get up to do translating, usually around 2 or 3 o'clock he would get up and do his translating of Srimad Bhagavatam, Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita at that time. And that would be interspersed with japa. And also, through the day, he didn't have so much of a very strict time, and he would just sit in japa. In the time I was with him, I've been asked this many times, how many rounds did Prabhupada chant? I never asked him, but as far as I could see, he seemed to make it a rule to finish his 16 round every day and chant his 3 gayatris. And the reason I say this is there have been instances when he's kind of mentioned this fact. And one was in an evening, I think it was also here in Los Angeles, when Prabhupada was sitting and talking, and he was chanting also. And he finished chanting around, and he pulled down his counter bead, and he said, there, he said, now I am finished my 16 rounds, so I can do whatever I want. And he also mentioned at times, he'd say, you know, what is the difficulty in chanting 16 rounds? He said, when I was a householder, he said, I would chant my 16 rounds simply by chanting 4 rounds after each meal. He said, before I would do anything, when I finished eating, I would chant 4 rounds. He said, of course, early in the morning, then after breakfast, lunch, and dinner, he would chant these 4 rounds. And he actually even was doing that when he was here. Very often after lunch, he would always chant. He would never, after lunch, he would normally take rest for anywhere from a half hour to an hour and a half. But he would never take rest before chanting after his meal. And I could see that he was, chanting his rounds in this way. And also in the evening, he would take rest sometimes from anywhere from 9 o'clock to 11 o'clock, sometimes a little later. But sometimes when I would be massaging him, depending on if he had finished his rounds or not, he would sit up in the bed and he would chant. You know, if his rounds were finished, then he would just lie down and doze off or whatever. So he was always very conscious of the rounds, chanting rounds. And his gayatri, also his gayatri he would always do right before his morning walk, which was also sometimes very amusing, because there were times when his the devotees that were going on the morning walk, sannyasis or temple presidents or GBCs, they would sometimes filter into the room just before the morning walk. Usually no one, went into Prabhupada's quarters before the morning walk, but sometimes I would just kind of filter in, and Prabhupada would be getting ready, and everyone just liked to watch him get ready, the way he put on tilak, you know, everything is done very artfully, just the way his movements were. And then he would, after putting on his tilak, he would sit up very straight and would start to say Gayatri. And the natural inclination of everyone was to say Gayatri at that time, which I immediately would find amusing, because Prabhupada always chanted his Gayatri quicker than anyone else. So he would chant his Gayatri, then he would get up and you'd see all these faces as they were trying to finish their finish their Gayatris and not miss the morning walk at the same time. So I just kind of look around, head out the door. Usually they would just get up and make it at that point, but it was always interesting to see. Morning walks are a very nice time. I mean, out of the whole day that I spent with Prabhupada, some the most ecstatic moments in their priority started with the evening massage, which was always the most nectar for myself, because it was the one time out of the 24 hours that I was always alone with Prabhupada. And sometimes he would talk about his childhood, or he would say things about Krishna, or sometimes he would say nothing, but it was always very nice to be with Prabhupada like that. And then the next was, of course, his massage in the afternoon. That was also always nectar. And then after that was the morning walk. It's the morning walks were always nice. Prabhupada was usually preaching. Sometimes, you see, once with myself, this wasn't a morning walk, it was a massage. This was also in Australia. And Prabhupada was at the time. Listen, there's these different tapes of morning walks where Prabhupada was questioning devotees and asking them to assume different roles as scientist, you know, or the materialist, and, you know, what would they say to this and what would they say to this? So in that spirit, Prabhupada one day during the massage, he said, so what would the scientist say about accepting the authority of the Vedas? So, because the Vedas is our mother. So what would their response to this be? And so I was trying to assume that role, and I said, well, Prabhupada, they would say, you know, that I have to accept the fact that the Vedas is my mother, just as someone says, I am your mother, and you have to believe her, that she actually is your mother and that she's not lying to you. And then he snapped back at me. He said, you do not accept this? He said, you have been with us for so long? He said, and you do not accept that the Vedas are our mother? And I was like totally baffled. And I said, yes, Prabhupada. And he said, oh. He said, so what would they say then? And I said, oh boy. This isn't my day. So again, we went into this, I assumed this consciousness, and I was trying to answer him as a materialist, which I was very good at being. And I said, well, they would, you know, I answered him in the same way, and he started yelling at me again. And he said, you have been with us for so long, he said, and still, he said, you do not understand. So at that point, I just had to stop. I could see that I was in a very dangerous situation, and very inadequate, I imagine, in many respects. I was with Prabhupada for so long, I'm sure he knew all my innermost feelings and doubts. So I didn't continue that way. But there was another time, it was also in Australia. This was during an evening massage. And there were also a lot of mosquitoes in the room at that time. But that's something else. But Prabhupada was talking, and at the time, he was translating the fifth canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. And it had to do a lot with the planetary systems, the position of the planets and the sun and the miles. And he was recalling, and he said, one of my servants, he said, that I had, when I told him that we never went to the moon, he said, he left us. He said, he could not accept that. He said, you will not leave, will you? I said, no, Prabhupada. I said, I believe it. He said, oh, that's good. He said, I don't want you to go away like he did. Any other questions? Okay, that's easy. Prabhupada, from the very first time I massaged him, I learned from, I watched Sudama, that time Sudama Maharaj massaged Srila Prabhupada. And this was like the very first day of my service as a servant to him. And that was always the thing I was most fearful of doing, was massaging him, just touching him. You know, I had never massaged anyone before in my life, and I didn't want to have to start with Prabhupada. So it was the first day, and I was sitting there, you know, trying to watch everything he was doing, and his hand going this way and that way, over the head, over his back. And so the next day, Sudama, again, I said, so, you know, you go in and do it again, and I'll watch again, and I'll, you know, really try to figure out what's going on. So we both went in a room, and Prabhupada said, no, it's all right. He said, Shuddha Kirti can do it today. That was my moment of truth. So it just went along, and Prabhupada didn't say very much. But the way his massages work, you would always start with his head. And mostly his massage was a rub down. And on his head, normally you would use sandalwood oil. Unless he didn't feel well, then you would use mustard oil, because sandalwood oil had a cooling effect. So if he was feeling a little chilled or feverish, then it wasn't good to use. So he would always massage his head with sandalwood. Leg. And he said, do it like this. And he grabbed my leg, and I jumped up in the air, and it was all of a sudden, you know, somebody grabbed me, Prabhupada was grabbing my leg. And he said, do it like this. You know, then I learned an extra little thing. And another time, I was massaging him, and he grabbed my head, and he said, do it like this. So in this way, you know, picked up how Prabhupada wanted me to massage his body. And another item in massaging him was that you massaged each part of his body until he told you to go to the next part. So sometimes you may massage his head for an hour. He may be talking to someone in the room, and you'd be there massaging and massaging. And Prabhupada was just talking and sitting and listening, and you're kind of waiting for, you know, when to go to the next spot. And that was like the most difficult, if you happened to be massaging his back. When you were massaging his back, he would say, do it as hard as you can. You know, as hard as you can do it, he said, I can take it. So when you did his back, you really liked to put, you know, everything you had into it. So, but if you were doing that, putting everything you had into it, and Prabhupada was talking with someone, it became very difficult. I would get a little tired. And but actually, there was one time when I was with him, somehow or other, I started just doing it on my own. I would massage his head for a while, then I would go to his back, and without him saying anything. And this went on for a few weeks. And finally, one day I was massaging his head, then I went to go to his back, and he said, you massage until I tell you to stop, not until you tell you to stop. So that was the last time I did that method. But the massage generally took about an hour and 15 minutes, and sometimes it could take, you know, 2.5 hours of just, you know, massaging Prabhupada's body, which is, you know, it was very wonderful, especially doing his feet. There were times in the evening when Prabhupada would be lying in bed and I would massage. Again, this was the same situation. In the evening when I massaged him, you would massage until he told you to leave, which sometimes, you know, you didn't know when it was going to be, because he would fall asleep while you were massaging him. And so you would just sit there, depending on the situation, you would be sitting in his bed or, you know, standing at the side of his bed and just massaging and massaging. And when he would fall asleep, I would massage his legs, and then I would put my head down, put him to his feet, you know, bring it back up, and then massage it. Massage his feet. I would try to do it in such a way that he couldn't detect that my head was going to his feet. But then sometimes also in the evening, I have to admit, due to my material contamination and my mode of ignorance, I would even start falling asleep at the massage, and then it would become very difficult, and I would start massaging, and I would try to massage a little harder so that Prabhupada would be aroused, so that he knew I was still there. Otherwise, I didn't know if I would be spending the whole night there. And sometimes he would say, "Are you tired?" And I would say, "Oh, no, Prabhupada, I'm fine." And we would both doze off together, massaging. Prabhupada, in the evening time, is, again, why I liked it so much, was sometimes he would become just like a child. I mean, so much so that it was just astounding. And I can remember times when I would massage him, and he would say, "All right, that's enough." And he would, just in one movement, he would grab his covers and go, pull them over his head, you know. Or he would just do things like, you know, he would curl up in these little, you know, situations, and but he always looked so childlike. And then other times he would be so philosophical, he would go and say, "I hate taking rest." He said, "It's a complete waste of time." He said, "I wish I didn't ever have to take rest." He said, "I'm just simply wasting my time." But mostly he would be very childlike in taking sleep. And it was observed by so many devotees, and they would, you know, do whatever they could to watch Prabhupada in bed, because he just looked so wonderful lying in bed. So he would assume sometimes these positions. Once it was in Mayapur, where his room, his sitting room in Mayapur, was complete cushions all against the wall and on the floor. And you might pass by sometime and you'd see him. He would have one cushion under his head, and then he would be lying down, and then he would have this big bolster under his knees, you know, and his body would be like that, and he'd just be lying there very peacefully. He could rest. As he said, was a Bengali proverb, if you give a person a place to sit, he'll lie down. And Prabhupada was very expert, as no matter where he was, he never found it difficult to lie down and to take rest when he felt like doing it. And it was always very peaceful, which was, could show his transcendental abilities. Managing the ISKCON society was so trying. If you can imagine, every day there was, you know, one or two dozen emergency situations that people were trying to stress. But above and beyond all of that, Prabhupada could chant his rounds, do his translation, and he could be very peaceful and just transcend the whole situation.
Thank you very much. So we're going to start the Abhishek of Srila Prabhupada in about 3 or 4 minutes. The deity doors will open first. But right now, can we have a few volunteers to hold the cloth in front of Srila Prabhupada's Vyasasan so that the pujaris can begin to undress Srila Prabhupada? Is there anybody who will volunteer to do that? Just three men can please come up. And keep trying to get the cloth from, what's his name? From Ramanya. He's got the cloth here. So now what's going to happen is Srila Prabhupada will be undressed, and then he'll be carried over, agreed to duties, and be carried over to his bathing platform, whatever we call it. And the process for bathing would be that the devotees can kind of line up in this direction facing the altar and along the front of the altar, and they'll enter from this side over here and bathe Srila Prabhupada, or the conch shell. The pujaris will give them the necessary equipment, and then they can pass on through the other side. Please don't offer your obeisances or something like that inside the bathing arena, because that would mean that it would hold up everyone else for the bathing. All right. So I think Parasati Prabhu, you were going to start, you were going to chant, right, during this, you know. All right.
Do you like to say that? What is ahead, but also they don't concern us that much if we are properly situated as the servants of Krishna. Just like in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna has to describe to Arjuna all the considerations of the yogi in trying to pass from his body. What is the season? What is the proper time of the day? What is the proper placement of the life airs? So many things the yogi has to be concerned with, how to expertly pass. But then Krishna says, but the devotee doesn't think about any of these things. He doesn't even think about them. They're completely unimportant to him. So in the same way, although these descriptions are there and they're ghastly, they do not affect the devotee of the Lord who has developed his eternal consciousness as the servant of Krishna. And that is the secret to conquering death. And we can stop there. If anyone have any questions. Or comments. Just a moment.
When one hears, my dear, I want to conquer death, that is very,
very what? Yes. Devotee is the eternal optimist.
So, but in the beginning, one can keep this to be a fact, the aspect set in place. So we may need a better or a clearer vision for one to be a realization of this fact to be a fact.
Yes. Yayatamam prabhajante tam stataiva bhajamiyaha. As much as you surrender to Krishna, he reveals and reciprocates with you. So the more you situate yourself on the transcendental platform of spirit soul, Brahman, which means, I am the eternal servant of Krishna, I have no other business, no other plans, no other desires, no other business in this life than serving Krishna. The more you situate yourself in that consciousness, the more this will be revealed, the more you will see how this is true. So you go on practicing Krishna consciousness, following the regulative principles, chanting, reading, following all the different practices, and fixing the mind always. What is the plan of Krishna, my guru? That's my plan. What service can I render? That is the mentality of a pure servant of Krishna. So you just go on practicing Krishna consciousness and fixing your mind in that way. And you will see that everything becomes revealed.
Very well. I once invited my mother to join the movement.
Yes, actually that is the Vedic program, that is Krishna's program. That in in old age, one should retire timely, not hold on to the last breath to material conceptions and material relationships and the material paraphernalia that one has been gathering, which is all useless. In the end, it's all useless, it has no value. So rather than just holding on to something useless until the very last breath, one should retire timely from material life and join Krishna consciousness movement. That is actually Krishna's plan.
The person has, say one person has developed pure love of Krishna and at the time of death is able to remember Krishna. And another person, he may not have developed pure love of Krishna, but he's able to chant and to somehow remember something about Krishna.
That is sufficient. But if you study very carefully in Bhagavad Gita, in the 8th chapter, Krishna explains that whatever consciousness you have, whatever thoughts you have at the moment of death, that state you will attain. Now, in his purport, Srila Prabhupada explains that do not think that you can spend an entire lifetime in nonsense thoughts and nonsense activities and then just be thinking, but at the time of death, I will give all of that up and just think of Krishna. Prabhupada explains in that purport that what you think of at the time of death is merely the, you could say, the reaction to what you've been thinking about throughout your life. It's not that it will be different. It will not be different. Therefore, do not waste time, because the sum total of your thoughts in this life will suddenly appear in your mind at the moment of death. That which you are attached to in the course of your life will appear in your mind at the time of death, and that is the state that you will attain. So therefore, we have to make it while we're young, our thoughts on Krishna, on service to Krishna, our attachments fixed on Krishna above everything else that we're attached to. Krishna's plan. Then that's what you'll think of at the time of death. So that is the training that the Krishna Conscious Movement offers. We are training our members in this way. And then automatically, at death, they will be thinking of Krishna. It will not be a big struggle. It will be natural.
Isn't there something that says that a devotee, you know, a devotee, then even though you may forget Krishna, Krishna won't forget you.
Yes. Yes, we heard that story in the last week, told by several devotees, of experiences they had, either near-death experiences themselves or watching another devotee die, that suddenly Krishna was there in the devotee's mind, helping them. Yes, that is actually a fact. If you have been a devotee throughout your life, then even if you become overcome by the disease in old age, just prior to death, then it will not matter. Even that will not matter. If you cannot do it on your own due to your bodily functions and mental functions being too dislocated, the Krishna will not forget the service you have rendered. He will appear, even if you're incapable of remembering him, he'll appear anyway. That is the intimate relationship that Krishna has with his devotees. Therefore, we don't want to be anything else but Krishna's devotee. But not just in the general sense, but in the sense of that every moment of our life, we want to spend it in Krishna's service. This is another characteristic of a Vaishnava, that he is always thinking how every moment is for Krishna. He never forgets this point. Every moment in my life, I have given it to Krishna and I've given it to my spiritual master. I'm not keeping some of it for me. Vaishnava tries to develop that type of devotion. that's mentioned in the Nectar of Devotion by Rupa Goswami as one of the characteristics of one in ecstatic love. So we should try to develop that type of thinking, that every moment is for Krishna. In that way, we spend our life as his devotee, and we have no fear at all of death. From any point you bring up, we have no fear of death. No, of course, that is eternal. And the body which is used in Krishna consciousness is not considered material. And for the devotee who is situated in pure service to Krishna, heaven and hell are the same. Because his service attitude has immunized him from the material pangs. So it doesn't even matter. He may take another birth in somewhere in the material world. He may join Krishna where he is appearing in the universe, performing his lila. Either way, the devotees will just go on serving Krishna and will accept, this is Krishna's plan for me. That's all. I don't care. This is Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's final statement of the science of pure devotion. My Lord Krishna, I am your eternal servant. You may do with me as you like. You may trample me or you may embrace me. You may neglect me. You're free to do whatever you want with me. But as far as I am concerned, I am your eternal servant. Life after life, I love you, and whatever you want to do with me is okay with me. That is pure devotion. Now you have to understand how the Vaishnava can pray like that. Why? What is the philosophy behind such statement? You must study very carefully to understand these points. And when you study, they become very clear. And when you actually act in pure devotion, then they become even more clear. And then we can stop there. All glories to Sri Sri Guru and Gauranga.
Lord Chan Prabhu and Srila Kirti could come and sit up here. Okay. Get a little assembly together. At this time we're just going to hear something of Srila Prabhupada's pastime, some remembrances from some of the senior devotees in the community. And we each talk for maybe 5 minutes or so. So I'd just like to begin by relating one of the many wonderful and infinite pastimes of Srila Prabhupada during his short sojourn on this planet. In 1968, six of us, went to London with Prabhupada's blessings to open the center there. And after a year of very difficult times, we were able to procure one building in the center of London. And we knew that Prabhupada wanted this. So when he came, he was in a very happy mood. And at the time when he arrived, because we had just made a record of the Hare Krishna mantra with George Harrison and the Beatles label Apple, they were able to get a very large collection of press people to come and view Prabhupada along with the devotees. So Prabhupada was very happy, and he was escorted from the plane into the VIP lounge. There was a big kirtan. Prabhupada led the kirtan, and he, after the kirtan, was immediately surrounded by newsmen, and they were, as usual, very aggressive. And the first question was, someone shoved the microphone towards him, "What have you come here to teach?" And Prabhupada said, "I have come here to teach you what you have all forgotten, God." So they were very stunned. They'd never heard anyone speak quite so strongly. And then the devotees were also a little shocked. They were kind of stunned into silence. And then when Prabhupada went to his quarters, which were in John Lennon's estate, he began to speak about how England had fallen down so much from its former material glory of the emperors of the whole world.